Okay, I'm here. My name's Gary Parrish, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. And I'm talking to you on the morning of November 11th, which means the tip-off marathon isn't too far away. It gets started, I think it's 7 Eastern tonight, Kent State and Temple. It's going to roll all the way through the night, into the morning, culminates on Tuesday night, of course, with the Champions Classic, the spectacular doubleheader in Chicago, for which I'll be courtside. My colleagues, Matt Norlander and Jeff Porzella, will surely, I'm assuming, be watching from their couches. And right now, they're with me on this edition of the podcast because it's Monday, and I'm going to spend every single Monday talking with them. Fellows, good morning.
Good morning, GP. Yeah, we're going to switch this up and do Mondays as a trio then?
Yeah, I think there's more to talk about coming off of a weekend. Yeah. Why wait to Tuesday to do that, right? We're obviously adjusting on the fly. When we had all our very important meetings in the offseason, we had settled on a Tuesday podcast, but I think I'd rather spend Monday with you guys if you don't mind.
That's fine. I like to start my week with you guys.
It's very nice, very sweet. All right, listen, so let me ask, is either of you going to try to stay up for the whole marathon, which is actually more than 24 hours? I think you guys, maybe both of you, if you've done this before, are you ambitious enough to try it again, or stupid enough to try it again?
Yeah, I never have done this. Porzella, you've done it a couple of times.
I've done it twice.
It's this Twitter point of pride for some of you dudes, but I never saw the value of being up at 3 in the morning to watch college basketball.
No, particularly bad games. Like, you get these people, and inevitably, you watch. Overnight, you're going to see people, and it'll actually start throughout today, talking about how I'm going to stay up all night. I'm going to watch all of it. Dude, if you stay up, keep in mind, I do this for a living. If you stay up and watch early November college basketball games for more than 24 hours straight, you're an idiot. Like, there's something, like, you have no life. You have no other, like, you probably need, like, help. You should, once it's wrapped up, go see a doctor, figure out what's wrong with you, because though it is it's a neat event, I guess, the idea that one person would watch all of it is pretty dumb to me.
I'll probably watch BYU Stanford at 11.
Sure.
And then I'll probably watch the first half of Wichita State, Western Kentucky, and then, you know, see what happens. If I'm wide awake, I'll keep watching, but I doubt I'll be.
Norland, are you going to bed relatively early?
I'll probably crash around 1:30 in the morning. Yeah. It's good to see Porzella's grown. Porzella led this charge of,
I'm saying, the point. I used to do it no problem. I would get a bunch of candy and Chex Mix and caffeine and just roll through it no problem. But then one year I got food poisoning midway through.
Mm.
That was a nightmare. And I think that kind of was a signal not to do this ever again.
Yeah, if it were like NCAA tournament games staggered for 24 straight hours, then I still wouldn't do it. I mean, I'm an old man. At some point you got to go to bed. But I could at least understand it. The idea, here's the thing that I don't get. When these guys or girls, whoever they are, they take some sort of it's a source of pride to say that you watched a irrelevant basketball game at 4 a.m. Well, like some of these games, if they came on at 6 p.m., I'm not watching them.
Right.
Like, the idea that you would watch irrelevant, bad, off the radar basketball just to say you did it seems like a poor use of time for it. But who am I to tell other people what to do with their time, right?
That's also
true. If Syracuse is playing Tennessee at 5 a.m.,
sure,
I'd probably watch it. But New Mexico State of Hawaii, it's not doing it for me. Like, you're right. Like, if that game was on at 7 o'clock, I'm not watching it. Like, I'd rather watch Seinfeld reruns.
that's my thing. Like, yeah, if you put Michigan State Kentucky on at 4 a.m., I will get up and watch it or be there or whatever.
Right.
Like, I remember one time, AAU stuff out in Vegas, right? And my favorite gym, which is Foothill, which they don't don't use it enough anymore since the Sonny Vaccaro's event has stopped. But there was a Sunday morning sort of kick off the evaluation period game between Derrick Rose and Derrick Rose and Eric Gordon were on one team, and O.J. Mayo and Bill Walker were on a team. And that game tipped off at 8 a.m. on a Sunday. And so I was like, okay, you got to be there. Like, you can't miss that. You can't go to Vegas to watch summer basketball and reasonably miss Derrick Rose, Eric Gordon against O.J. Mayo and Bill Walker. So I was at Foothill, at 7:45 a.m. on a Sunday in Las Vegas, which is very difficult to do for a variety of reasons. But that made sense. But the idea – so I say that to say this. there are people who will get up to go to an 8 o'clock on a Sunday game in Vegas between, like, two irrelevant AAU teams, which I'll never understand. Like, what do you do? Like, why? What is the point? Just to say? People love to be able to say they did stuff without recognizing that it can be a pointless exercise sometimes.
They like to brag about their grind, man. This is Borzello can float into that realm. He loves to brag about his grind on the random AAU trails, right, buddy?
Yeah, man. Like it's if you can say you went to an 8 o'clock game and you saw some player that came out of nowhere and then like 2 years later he's a stud and you say, oh, I saw him in an 8 a.m. game in Vegas. You sound like a stud, man. You sound like a grinding scout.
The only thing that could possibly get me to an 8 a.m. game in Vegas is Derrick Rose, Eric Gordon, OJ Mayo, and Bill Walker. All right, before we look too far ahead, let's take a look back at the opening weekend of college basketball. What stood out to you, Norlander? What's the story from the opening weekend of college basketball?
The foul thing is what people are going to talk about most.
Or is that what we are going to talk about most? I wonder how many people actually
care. Yeah, okay.
Care.
So, good. Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. The number of fouls and how the game is called, that does intrigue me, generally speaking, because this is something that's affecting the very way college basketball is played, just the new rules on hand-checking and block charge and stuff. And I do feel like there will be times to look at that and what's been influenced. To me, small sample size, it's only been 1 week, and we're kind of rushing a little bit, although it was notable that Seton Hall Niagara had 73 fouls in a regulation game, and no game last year had that many that didn't go to overtime. So, you know, we were 48 hours into the season and we already had more fouls in one game than we had in all 5 months of it for a year ago. So I thought that was notable. To me, this happened late Sunday night, but it's not like the Beavers are necessarily an NCAA tournament team. And I don't know if Oregon State should be the team I think is leading a national headline over the weekend, but I also know what you guys are. I think I know what you're going to talk about, so I don't want to step on that topic. But Craig Robinson losing again to Coppin State, a team from the MEAC, which only has two wins over major conference teams over the past two seasons, essentially. And the only other win was Norfolk State winning in the tournament against Missouri. To me, Oregon State has just developed this pattern of really bad non-conference losses, and they get it again. They did have two players suspended in Eric Moreland and Devin Collier, but still, it's worrisome, and I also found it hilarious and predictable that we put up this news, and I tweeted it out from our Eye on College Basketball account Sunday, you know, Oregon State loses to Coppin State, and Parrish retweets it, and then I get 12 at mentions basically blaming Obama.
it's what's interesting because I don't want to say that the reason Craig got the job is because of his sister is the First Lady of the United States, his brother-in-law is the President of the United States, but certainly that's a part of his story. It's the main part of his story, and Oregon State on some level, I think the administrators would admit that they knew that they would get some pop off of hiring him because he was – you know, he was famous in a way that's, you know, rare for college basketball coaches or people in general. I can tell you this. I've been to Corvallis once, and it was to see go see Craig Robinson right after he got the job, and not necessarily because Oregon State had a new basketball coach, but because his brother-in-law was about, at this time, 4 or 5 months away from being becoming the first African-American president of the United States. And so what's interesting to me is that Oregon State probably on some level, at least on some level, hired Craig for all of the attention that he could bring their program. And, of course, the byproduct of that is that when you're bad, we notice and pay attention in a way that we otherwise wouldn't. I don't know that Oregon State registers in basketball with anybody nationally. You know, maybe in certain parts of the country, but not nationally. And yet, when Oregon State loses that game on Sunday night, it was all over Twitter. Why? Because it's Barack Obama's brother-in-law, I think, is the main reason.
Yeah. No, that's what stood out to me. Personally, more than anything. And then the other quick side note here was that Kevin Ware didn't play for Louisville. Louisville kind of struggled with College of Charleston just a little bit. They ended up pulling away at the end. Charleston's got a solid team. But I think most were expecting Ware to play because he had played in an exhibition just a few days before. We come to find out Rick Pitino says Ware has a noticeable limp in practice, although Ware himself, Pitino also said Ware himself doesn't realize he's playing with the limp, so it's going to be another 2 weeks, which I think is just, if you had said this like 2 months ago, we would have said, oh yeah, naturally, Kevin Ware, you know, he won't start the season, but there was a lot of talk from Ware and Pitino in Louisville that he was going to be ready. You know, it's not the most shocking thing, Borzello, that that what Pitino said didn't turn out to be, because he can sometimes intentionally or unintentionally mislead. But I thought that was maybe the biggest overall headline from the weekend, was the fact that, you know, we expected him to play and he didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people, you know, want to see him play, see how he would be after, I guess, you know, breaking his leg and then gruesome injury about 8 months ago. But, you know, I didn't watch the game, but I was checking my phone and I saw that, you know, he's 2 weeks away. And I think it surprised everyone. But again, like, Louisville doesn't need him for another 2 weeks. And, you know, if they were, like, there's rumors that Shane Bohannon's coming back in a week and Luke Hancock is coming back in a week. So, you know, Louisville, there's, you know, they'll be full in a couple of weeks. And I think that they're going to be, you know, back among the nation's elite. And clearly they don't really need him that badly right now. So, like, they could let him take his time.
I was less interested, I think, in whether Kevin Ware played over the weekend than that, because I think the moment that you're waiting on, to the extent that you're waiting on a moment, is the moment that he steps back onto the court, right? And we got that like last week in an exhibition. He checks into a game, he gets a standing ovation, he makes his first shot, he gets a standing ovation, he talks about it afterward, Rick talks about it afterward, and then, like, whatever. I guess I assumed, like everybody else, that he would be playing in the regular season opener. But, like, I don't – once we've seen somebody, or maybe – maybe I got it wrong, but it seems to me once we've seen somebody back in uniform run on a court, make a shot, then that story, to the extent that it's a story, is over with, isn't it?
I think people just want to see it in a you know, quote unquote real game. You know, exhibition games are one thing, but I think most people aren't watching Louisville exhibition games.
That's fair.
And so I think that if he plays in a real game on ESPN or CBS or whatever, that's when people are gonna, you know, take notice and say, oh, you know, he broke that leg 8 months ago, and look what he's doing now.
I do want to go back to what Norlander started with when I asked him about the story from the weekend, because of the fouls. I don't know how much, say, you know, three guys at the bar sitting around, you know, discussing the new hand-checking rules in college basketball, but there is no question that this is a story among industry folks and coaches. And like you said, and you wrote about this over the weekend, Niagara and Seton Hall, they had 73 fouls in that game. And so people are complaining about the number of fouls and by extension, how long it can make the games go. I think this one was, what, nearly 2.5 hours?
Yeah, just under 2.5.
Right. So, but isn't the solution, like, I guess we could debate this forever. Isn't the solution as simple as, you know what, stop fouling? I got an idea. Hey, I got an idea, Niagara and Seton Hall. Stop fouling. You know the rules. It's not like we're changing the rules. In other words, there's a street outside, you know, maybe, you know, right up outside my subdivision, right? And it's got a speed limit that's 35 miles per hour, which seems slow, but whatever. But if they made it 20 tomorrow, then I would just start – I would recognize that it's 20. And then I would start driving 20, and I might complain about it, but I at least know what the deal is. The you know, if the purpose of this rule is to change behavior, then this was always going to happen if behavior didn't change. So change the way you guard, then we won't have the fouls, and then I think most basketball people agree we'll have a better game, a cleaner game, a game that flows a little more freely. So I'm willing to put up with this if the end game is that we get a better version of basketball in general.
I agree. I think it's tough to instinctually change defensive habits for a lot of players over the course of one off season. I think it's going to be hard at times to watch some stuff. I also think this is a natural yet easy talking point for college basketball throughout the season. In many ways legitimate, in other ways it's just going to be the default, let's go talk. Like, if there could have easily been a game without these new rules where we had 65 fouls and offense was bad, and we just, you know, we would have talked about it for other reasons. But now that we specifically have this protocol in place for not hand checking and just a complete change in defensive philosophy, I've prepared myself to have to know that I'll have to write about it probably weekly, and for it to become part of the national conversation about college basketball for the entire year. I do think it can get overblown in certain instances, and I think we will see plenty of instances where teams aren't fouling that much. Go ahead, Borzello.
If you look at the teams that are committing all these fouls, they're mostly bad teams. I mean, you look at, I think Michigan State committed like 12 fouls, Louisville committed 14, Notre Dame had 15. So they're like the top 25 teams aren't, you know, most of them aren't really being affected by this. And I think that's something to watch, that the good teams aren't, you know, missing a beat defensively, but the bad teams, maybe the less talented teams, are having trouble adjusting.
Which makes sense, and which is the way it ought to be. Because, like if you would make me guard Marcus Smart, right? Well, I got no shot unless I can grab him, and I probably have no shot even then. I'm an inferior everything, athlete, player, human, man. I'm just inferior on every level. So I couldn't do anything with the guy, right? Well, so what does this do? If you can't give an inferior player an advantage by using his hands, if you take that away, then whatever gap there is between these two players that are competing against each other should be magnified, which I'm fine with. The idea that you could grab people, hold people, touch people to guard them in this sport never made much sense to me, and it really did bog things down. So if this is, and I think Borzello makes a good point, what we're seeing here is perhaps a reflection of that, that the bad players and the, you know, which represent, you know, the bad teams are the ones getting called for more fouls because they can't compete otherwise. What it reminds me of, though, and Norlander pointed this out, that it can be difficult to change the way you do everything in the span of one offseason. In other words, if you're guarding somebody and for your whole life, when a guy goes goes right, your instincts are to put your hands up on him, then it can be very difficult, I acknowledge, to not do that anymore. Although you should have been working on it all offseason and been taught all offseason, I understand that somehow or sometimes you're just going to do what comes naturally to you. And what comes naturally to college basketball players is because of the way they've played for so long, is just touch, you know, put your hands up. It reminds me a little bit of what I've seen in the NBA over the first couple of weeks. They put in a new rule in the offseason that once a ball goes through a basket, an offensive player is not allowed to touch it. In other words, I live in Memphis. So Zach Randolph, gets a layup and the ball falls through. He can't, even if it falls straight to him underneath the basket, he can't catch it and then drop it on the baseline or catch it and pass it to a ref or touch it, tap it in any way. And the reason is because,
really?
Yeah, well, here's why. Because what was happening is every time a team would score around the bucket, a dunk, a layup, somebody would on the team that has now got to get back on defense would tap the ball. You know, it looks innocent, but it's by design, and it's to slow down. You know, if you're playing a team that wants to get out and run on you, it's to slow that down.
Yeah.
So now the new rule is you cannot touch the ball. If your team scores and that ball goes through the net, you are not allowed to touch it. Or I think it's a delay game warning and then and then free throws after that. But what I've seen over and over again is guys just do it out of instinct. Like they're not, you know, like Mark Gasol, I saw up close last week. He laid a ball in and then, you know, and then it fell through and it fell right basically on top of him, right? And he grabbed it and just tossed it to the, you know, to the baseline, tapped to the baseline. Whistle blows, they give him a warning. And he sort of shrugged his shoulders like, what did I, you know, come on, man. But that's the rule. You're not allowed to do that anymore. And it's a rule put in place for a purpose. And this is, again, a different kind of rule, but with this, I think it'll have the same kind of effects. Guys are going to hand check even when they don't realize they're doing it. And so the foul numbers are going to go up. But ultimately, whether it takes 2 months or 2 years, I think most people who you know understand this sport are going to tell you that when the kids learn to play and start playing the right way, the proper way, then we're going to have a game that's easier to watch and more fun to watch and more entertaining to watch, and whatever price we have to pay to get there, I think it's probably a worthwhile price.
I agree, in short, because there's a huge dichotomy in contradiction with college basketball that's been growing over the past 10 years, guys. The sport's never had better athletes, and it's never had worse team basketball. That shouldn't be the case. It should be as fun to watch now as it's ever been, given the product and the quality of athlete that we have on the floor. And I do think it's going to be inevitable over the course of the season that we're going to have more fouls on average, but we're going to have more points on average. And I don't know if this is something that we can get to in one season. I mean, the NBA basically had this kind of changeover about a decade back. It might take a little while because you got to also consider, you know, this is going to really improve the game aesthetically and the way it flows with, I think, the guys that are in high school now as they come in. So the product itself might not be what we want to envision it to be for another 2 or 3 years. But I also don't think that this is going to be just I think there was a natural overreaction to it's just going to be this brutal thing to watch, and it's going to be foul fest consistently, and we're going to have 2.5 hour games or 2-hour and 15-minute games. Borzello, again, to echo Parrish, I mean, what he said is right. The less talented teams will do that. And that'll actually always be true of sports. You know, if you're less physically gifted, you're going to instinctually try and do things that put you on a level playing field, and that's always going to happen. But I think naturally the game will get better. I just don't know, A, how fast that's going to happen, and B, I just don't think it's going to be unbearable, so to speak, for the casual fan.
Here's the other thing is that this won't be a story for the casual fans. Trust me. Nobody watched Seton Hall Niagara. All right,
right.
Our buddy Brendan Prunty watched it, and you saw his tweets, and so you then wrote about it. But nobody's watching that game. When this could be something that trends on Twitter, is if it happens in the Champions Classic, like if Kentucky and Michigan State have 70 fouls, or Duke and Kansas have 70 fouls, and Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker are on the bench with 2 fouls each, 4 minutes in because of a hand check 30 feet from the basket. That's when folks will start screaming. But anything short of that, I think is probably just going to be a conversation among people like us and basketball coaches. But if it happens on a big stage, folks are going to go crazy. But still, you know, the column I would write in response to that would be rooted in the idea of this is a necessary evil, so to speak, to get the sport back to where it needs to be. And if that's the case, I'm okay with it.
Agreed.
Yeah. Listen, let me ask you guys, if you were going to ask me what the storyline from the weekend
Gary was. Parrish, what is the storyline from the weekend?
I appreciate you doing that. Although hosting a radio show by myself, I am more than capable of asking myself questions. Hey, if I implied I need you to ask me anything, that's not true. but if I were looking back at the storyline for the weekend, I think it's the freshmen, the high profile guys, and the really nice performances they had right out of the gate. Julius Randle, who we named this morning the CBSSports.com Player of the Week, and also obviously Freshman of the Week. You know, averaged just massive numbers. I want to say it was around 24 points, 15 rebounds. Yeah. Was that what it is? So 20.
It was like 24.5 and 13.5 or something like that.
Yeah, no, 24.5, and they actually changed his box score. From the first game, he had officially had 14 rebounds. They ended up changing it to 15, or either it was 15 and they changed it to 16. Whatever it is, the averages now, I guess, are 24.5 points and 15.0 rebounds. I think that's the right number. Either way, monster numbers, regardless of the competition. Meantime, Andrew Wiggins got 16 points on 9 shots, and Jabari Parker got 22 points. Aaron Gordon at Arizona had a double-double right out of the gate. Just all these guys that we've spent so much time in the offseason talking about, and I think readers would tell you hyping, and some would argue overhyping. They showed up in their debuts. And it doesn't mean that they'll be this forever, although, damn, Randall's starting to look like he really might be this forever. But it does. It was a good first impression if for no other reason than it avoided people going, why did Andrew Wiggins only score 4 points? I thought he was supposed to be great. He wasn't overwhelming in the opener, but 16 points in your first college game, that's good by any standard.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would have gone with. That's kind of the storyline that stood out, just because all eyes were on them. Everyone wanted to kind of see at least one of them maybe kind of disappoint, just so they could point to us and say, this is what happens when you pick freshmen. And, none of them did. Pretty much all of the guys that we pinpointed going into the season had a pretty good opening weekend. The only problem is I think we're going to end up having this debate every week or probably twice a week about Randall versus Wiggins. And I think it's going to get tiresome by probably next week. It's just somebody asked me yesterday on Twitter, who do you take with the first pick? And I'm still taking Wiggins over Randall in the NBA draft. And, people say, oh, well, you see Wiggins, he only scored 16 against a terrible team, and Randall had 23 against UNC Asheville. I could care less what Julius Randle did against UNC Asheville. I still think that Wiggins is a better player. I don't think that'll change until I get some sort of sample size of 10, 15 games where they're both playing against elite competition.
What's funny is that folks try to make you – they want you to pit one against the other, like you're right. A Wiggins guy or a Randall guy. I love them both. I have them going first and second in the NBA draft. I had them both preseason, first team All-Americans. I think they're both terrific. Like, it's – and the idea that one is going to be, at least in theory, considered superior based off of stats is just something I will never buy into. I'm not going to be stupid. Julius Randle's the player of the week. Why? Because he put up incredible numbers two different times. But, you know, Eric Gordon had better stats than Derrick Rose. You know, Michael Beasley had better stats than Derrick Rose. Hell, a lot of people, including Chris Douglas Roberts, had better stats than Derrick Rose. Yeah, but that didn't, you know, people don't remember that about that Memphis team that played in the national championship game. Chris Douglas Roberts was a first team All-American. Derrick Rose wasn't. All right, but like when it came to, so I don't think that, and let me be clear, Julius Randle might end up being the college basketball player of the year, and then we might see Andrew Wiggins still go number one in the draft. Those two things don't have to go hand in hand. Michael Beasley was the one with the monster numbers in 2007-2008. Derrick Rose was the one who went number one overall in the NBA draft and went on to become the youngest MVP in NBA history. And so the idea that you've got to A, pay attention to stats, or B, the idea that Randall could be great somehow says something negatively about Andrew Wiggins just has never made sense to me. Like, I think most smart people would view it this way. They are both awesome, awesome talents. Randall, I do think, because of where he plays, not meaning Kentucky, but down, you know, in the front court, is going to allow him to put up, quote, better numbers, because he's going to get a lot of rebounds and stick backs that are going to add rebounds and add points. I think he's going to have better numbers than Andrew Wiggins, but I would have told you that 2 months ago. I don't think that necessarily means he will deserve to be the national player of the year at the end of the year. But at this point, you know, again, they're both spectacular, and I don't know why you have to be on one side of that argument or the other.
Yeah, I agree, and I also think with the Wiggins and Randall and probably Gordon leading the charge.
Jabari Parker, don't leave him out.
Shame on me for even forgetting Parker, because I feel like I champion him as much as any other. But I'm wondering, we're early, so we'll see how this develops. But I wonder if this might end up being the best year for freshman players in general since we went to the NBA, you know, mandating that players must do at least 1 year in college, just with the amount of talent out there, not just, you know, the headline guys. Borzello can speak to us as well as anyone in the industry. Just the talent of freshmen kind of at all levels. It feels like there's a lot of impact that's available out there, right?
Yeah, I mean, just the depth of at the top of the class. I think most NBA people have pinpointed this class as one where they can, you know, be picking eighth or ninth in the draft and still get a pretty good player. You know, I don't know if it has the, you know, I guess you can compare the elite star power to maybe the Derrick Rose, Kevin Love. Does it have that?
Yeah, that one was great. It was Derrick Rose, Kevin Love, Eric Gordon, O.J. Mayo, Michael Beasley. I mean, that one was terrific.
Yeah, I don't know if this class has the five guys that will go out and get 20 a game in the NBA or something like that. But I think 1 through 10, 1 through 12, I think you're going to get, you know, in the upcoming draft, I think you're going to get a pretty good player, an immediate impact player.
You know, and I think that's all true. And we are, listen, we're going to participate in or spark this, I don't want to say debate, let's call it conversation about these freshmen all year long. I think we'll be, or at least I know I'll be hope to be at the forefront. Like, I'm going to write about these guys because I think people are interested in them, and they're going to be future, you know, on some level, faces of NBA franchise. There's an audience for writing about and discussing Andrew Wiggins and Julius Randle and Aaron Gordon and Jabari Parker. And so I'm going to, you know, I'm going to participate in that. But the idea, what I won't do is overreact to every 40-minute episode of basketball that we see. And I fear that that's what folks are going to do, that Andrew Wiggins can score 16 in his opener and score, you know, 19 against Duke. But in the next game, if he goes for four, people are going to say, oh, most overhyped freshman in the history of basketball. And to me, that's what I would rather avoid, although I recognize it's probably unavoidable.
In the Twitter age, man, it's hard. And it's also when we're, you know, we use it so much. I mean, I get people listening to this, you know, fans probably use it frequently. Some might never use it. But for us, that's just what we need in order to keep track of everything that's happening. It is essentially our ever-updating newspaper. And with that, though, you get obviously interaction from fans and fellow writers and whoever. And the the knee-jerk thing, man, it's just become a part of the sports landscape.
Look, I mean, you look at Goodman's freshman column from...
Oh, God. You
talk to a scout who said, There's suddenly no way that Wiggins will be the number one.
Actually, my money was on Parrish bringing that up. Dude.
I've had that in the holster all podcasts. Waiting to bring that up.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I'm reading this because, like, listen, I read everything, right?
Right.
And, you know, I think when you have the job that we have, you got to read everything. Not that I wouldn't read Goodman anyway. I don't mean to imply that. like, hey, it's my job. I got to read the guy. He talked to NBA scouts who were at, you know, all of these guys' first game, the Kentucky game, the Kansas game, the Duke game, the Arizona game, and sort of got a quote about them. And the quote, I don't know who the scout is, although I wouldn't be put it past Goodman to just make that up. I'm joking.
The Marine Goodman.
I'm joking. I don't think he made it up. But it does fit the narrative that he's been hammering home for about 2 months. Anyway, so the quote was this from an NBA scout. Let's just... for the sake of the conversation, acknowledge that it's a legitimate quote. And I know it is. The guy says, there's no way Andrew Wiggins will be the number one pick in the draft. Like, are you an idiot? Like, what do you mean no way? No way? Like, no way. But you saw him for 40 minutes, and now the guy who everybody in the country has had tabbed as the number one player in the draft. And by the way, Goodman still says most NBA scouts still have him as the number one player in the draft. And suddenly there's a scout that exists who says there's, quote, no way. How about I'm not sure he's going to be the number one pick? Yeah. I'll take that. Or it's not a lock. Could be Randall or Dante Exum or any of the – oh, I'll take that. But there's no way that a guy on November 9th, 2013, said there's, quote, no way Andrew Wiggins will be the number one pick in the 2014 NBA draft. That guy is either, A, just being stupid – for the sake of being stupid, or B, is actually stupid, or C, is a made-up fictional character.
The thing is, I don't think NBA scouts like look at it like we are on like Twitter is, where they're adjusting their draft boards after every single game. I talked to one NBA guy like a couple weeks ago, and he was like, I don't have to do what you guys do. I don't have to have an opinion after every game. I have to know who I would take with the number one pick in 8 months. I don't really have to make a decision until 8 months from now. And it's like we're the exact opposite. We're coming up with an opinion, or Twitter is coming up with an opinion after every game on who's better and who's worse and who should be the number one pick and who should drop in the draft after every half of basketball. And it's just, I don't think NBA people think that way. And I think that
I'm with you completely, except for this guy has already ruled out Andrew Wiggins for the number one pick of the draft. You know, like, how about there's a variety of ways to express skepticism, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, I really like Julius Randle. If I were picking today, I'd take Randle over Wiggins. Perfectly reasonable opinion. It's not what I would do. I don't think it's what most NBA scouts would do, but it is a perfectly reasonable opinion to say, if I were drafting today, give me Julius Randle. I love that kid. I love Wiggins, but I'll take Randle over him. Perfectly reasonable thing to say. But the idea that the quote is no way Andrew Wiggins is the number one pick in the draft is the dumbest quote about a talented prospect that I've ever read in the month of November. It's rooted in just either you're just being difficult to be difficult or you're just dumb. Because I talked to an NBA guy last week as well, and just sort of picking his brain because this guy's going to the Champions Classic too. And I was like, so you're going to be up there? He said, yeah. And I said, so what do you think about these guys? I said, is it possible? Because you start to hear, and I think it's rooted in just silliness, but you still hear it. People saying, oh, Andrew Wiggins isn't as great as some of you think, blah, 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 blah. And like, I don't buy that, but that if you're on Twitter, that opinion has been tweeted. And so I said, I'm talking to this NBA guy. I said, is it possible that Wiggins could fall in the draft? Like in what scenario could he fall? Is it possible that he could fall? And the guy looked right at me and go, yeah, I mean, he could fall to two. I mean, that's it. Like, he could fall to two. He could maybe fall to two. That's his floor. His floor is basically two. So the idea that there's, quote, no way, it just drove me crazy. I could ruin my whole Sunday when I had to read that stupid quote.
Well, listen, it's a new day, it's a new week, so let's.
I'm not over it yet. I'm not over it yet.
Well, we last.
I hate stupidity. I don't hate differing opinions or contradicting opinions. I actually love a good conversation. Like, let's start the conversation with I'm taking Andrew Wiggins number one. You're taking Julius Randle number one. Okay, cool. Now let's talk about it. I enjoy that. I hate stupidity. I despise dumb people. And the idea that you could be quoted as saying there's, quote, no way that Andrew Wiggins could go number one in a draft in next June is just dumb.
Listen, when the season started last week, with a few days ago, you know, you had your 68 things you were looking forward to or, you know, whatever for the season. And as an offshoot, Borzello and I kind of took one of those things that you hit on and just expounded on it and wrote, you know, 500-word mini columns on it. And my thing was on Wiggins because he is the biggest story in college basketball. And so no matter the sport, whenever you have a subject matter that's that big, you're invariably and inevitably going to have people that are going to want to write on it in so many different ways. And a lot of those ways will be a bunch of crock. And Wiggins is clearly, and we're already seeing it with this. And it's going to be something of a circus to see how many different things we can praise and attack and build up and tear down Andrew Wiggins for. And it's unfair to the kid. And unfortunately, I just think it's going to be inevitable. And this kind of stuff is just the first part of that. I feel like this kind of thing that's grinding Gary's gears here I'm telling you, it's going to be bi-weekly or at the very least monthly. We're going to have some story about Wiggins where it's going to be like, what the hell are we talking about here?
How about this? And you want to know what this came after? How about this? You ready? This came after he scored a team high 16 points in a win for a top five team in the country in his college debut. That's what this came after. It wasn't like he went out and threw up a, you know, 4-point game. He had a team high 16 points in his college debut on 9 shots for a top 5 team in the country. And people are suddenly going, hey, there's no way. What are you talking about? Jesus Christ, drive. Anyway, so let's move on. The Champions, I could talk about that all day long. It drives me crazy. So the Champions Classic is Tuesday night. Which is the better game? Which one are you guys looking forward to more? Kentucky, Michigan State, which is obviously 1-2, or Kansas versus Duke, which is 4-5. But I think for more people, Andrew Wiggins versus Jabari Parker.
All right, well, I'll go first, I guess. I think that I am more excited about Kansas Duke just because the Wiggins Parker matchup. Kind of want to see the Kansas, you know, freshman against a good team. I want to see Duke, see if they can go with their kind of 5 perimeter player lineup, see if that works against a team that has Perry Ellis and Tarik Black and Joel Embiid. I just think that there's more, new things to see with those teams. I know Kentucky has, you know, all their freshmen and Michigan State's got a ton of talent, but I'm just looking forward to seeing Kansas and Duke, just seeing all their new guys and seeing how the lineups kind of, you know, flush out, I guess.
I think they're about even.
Pick one, Norlander. Christ.
All right, first of all. I got to finish the sentence here, guys. Okay. All right. They're about even, but I'm leading Michigan State, Kentucky, because I actually want to see – Michigan State is a team that a lot of people think is the best in the country right now. Kentucky's the clear number one, but then after that, people kind of lean toward MSU. I've got a little bit of skepticism with that. I want to see how they play. I think Gary Harris is an awesome player. They've got the bigs. Denzel Valentine, I think, is one of the more underrated players in the nation. So for them, with some serious veteran play to go against Kentucky, I think is a little more intriguing to me. Plus, we'll get Kentucky with, you know, its first true test with these freshmen and what they can do. So I would just slightly lean to the undercard, if you even want to call it that. And by the way, real quick, there were that 24-hour marathon, by the way, you know, just LSU at UMass, VCU at Virginia. There's a couple NC State, Cincinnati. There's like a few relatively decent.
No, there's good games. I was looking
at that. I think it's the best one we've had since it started. Basically.
Yeah. I was looking at some of the, even Tennessee Xavier is Tuesday night, which is a good guy. You know, I really like that Tennessee team, Robert Hubbs, Antonio Barton. And then, you know, they got one of the better front courts in the country with Jerron Maimon and Jarnell Stokes. And then of course, Jordan McRae on the wing. Like I'm looking for, like, I'd like to watch that game, but if I weren't going to be at the United Center. As far as that doubleheader in Chicago, I think I'm looking more forward to Kansas Duke because I really like the idea of seeing Jabari Parker and Andrew Wiggins, these two Sports Illustrated cover boys, on the court together. I don't know how much time they'll actually spend guarding each other. Some, and perhaps a lot, but I'm probably looking forward to that more. But the Kentucky-Michigan State game is undeniably intriguing as well because – you know, what happens, like, and keep, you know, I'm going to pick Kentucky just because, like, I've got them number one, so I'm not going to publicly contradict myself. But, you know, Michigan State is the older, experienced, and I don't want to say similarly talented, because I don't think anybody's really talented to the degree that Kentucky's talented, but talented enough at the college level to be really, really good, to be great. And sort of the narrative surrounding Kentucky is, but they're really young, and who knows if it'll come together. You thought it was going to come together last year, and it never did. And even if it does come together, it's going to take some time. What if they go out on November 12th and take care of Michigan State on a neutral court? Then what?
Like,
then what?
Like
then
demolish them,
or just beat them. Then what? Yeah. Then that goes out. Then the, oh, they're young. Are they going to figure it out? How long is it going to take them to figure out? Dude, they just beat Michigan State on a neutral. That
we'll find new narratives. They'll find new
of course
narratives.
They will.
They're
right.
Going to say they peaked too early. People were just surprised by them. Such a, yeah, those always be new stuff.
But I just wonder how scary it becomes.
Yeah.
If they go out and beat an experienced and talented Michigan State team that some people do have ranked number one on a neutral court on November 12th, you know, when we've still got, you know, 4 months or whatever to go, certainly plenty of time for them to, quote, hit their stride. The idea, if they could go out and handle this type of team this early, to me, should be terrifying for the SEC, because if they're already operating at that level now, where are they going to be in January?
I try not to overreact to one game, but I'm very intrigued to see what each of these four teams do, just because of the stage. There's a lot of hype surrounding it, naturally. They're all so talented, and to see what they can do at this point, I think it's just awesome for the sport. Just it'll clear to me. It's the football's football in November, but I mean this outruns any other non-football event for all of November, and how great of a thing is that for college hoops, you know?
All right, give me your picks. So Kentucky, Michigan State, who's the winner?
Okay, I'm going to go I'm going Kentucky, and I'm going to go Duke.
Kentucky and Duke. All right, Borzello.
I'm going to actually do the same. I think Kentucky's going to – I think they're going to beat Michigan State. Just they're more talented. I don't know if I trust Keith Appling 100%. Yes. And then Duke, I think I love Duke. I think that when they spread that floor and put the five perimeter guys out there, they're borderline unguardable. And I think they're going to beat Kansas.
I'm going to go Kentucky and Kansas based off nothing more than that's the way I have the schools ranked in the preseason. Nice. And I'm just trying to hold on to that for as long as I can. So I'm going to go Kentucky and Kansas while acknowledging that I'm perfectly capable, in fact, likely to be wrong. Either way, it should be a hell of a night. Well, listen, we've been talking long enough, I think. So let me wrap this up by telling you guys, Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello, thanks for joining me. And by telling the rest of you, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate you being here every week, listening to the podcast, reading what we write, interacting with us on Twitter. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. So make sure that you do that. And then I'll talk to you again later on this week. Take care.